Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation. Heard every Saturday at 4:20 p.m. online at americascannabisconversation.com. Each week, we provide our listeners information, education, and insight into the exploding medical and adult use cannabis industry. You'll hear from industry experts, elected officials, local growers, detractors, and more. Learn how to build your own cannabis business, how to grow the product, what's legal, and where it's legal. Tune in each week to hear the latest industry news and updates from the American Cannabis Industry Association in Washington, tips on investing in cannabis, personal success stories, and more. It's time to join the conversation. And here's your host, Dan Perkins.
This is Dan Perkins with your quick cannabis news. New York City. New York Police Department seized Vermont hemp shipment, mistaking it for marijuana. The New York City Police seized the shipment of what was believed to be 106 pounds of marijuana and arrested the buyer on criminal charges. But the Vermont farm that shipped the product said it's legal hemp, not marijuana. Fox Holler Farms, a hemp farm based in New Haven, Vermont, said every box of its product contained clear documentation and test results showing the undetectable levels of THC. Florida. More medical cannabis companies bolster operations in the lucrative Florida market following smokable flower ban repeal. A new Florida law repealing a ban on smokable medical marijuana products has given the state's medical marijuana market a shot in the arm, prompting large multi-state companies to aggressively expand their production, operation, and retail footprints. This has injected fresh competition into one of the nation's fastest growing medical cannabis markets and loosens the grip of the state's medical marijuana companies. Some multi-state operators possibly have overpaid to get into Florida. However, with reports of some acquisitions exceeding $40 million, including a $53 million transaction by Midman. Now to Ohio. Ohio prohibits vitamin E acetate in cannabis vape devices. Ohio medical marijuana regulators banned vitamin E acetate in vaping devices only days after the federal health officials linked the additive to cases of vaping-related lung illness. The ban is preemptive, as none of Ohio's licensed processors use the additive in its vape oils. And finally, we go to London, England. New European trade group hopes to help members put CBD products in stores. A fledgling United Kingdom-based trade group, which represents about 25 companies from Europe and North America, is seeking to allow its members to sell CBD product, even though that they might be in violation of European Union regulations, specifically because the EU considers CBD a novel food. The Association for the Cannabinoid Industry, ACI, is proposing that its members' businesses work closely with food regulators to foster full compliance and hopefully skirt a requirement for pre-marketing authorization. This has been your quick cannabis news. I'm Dan Perkins. Coming up on today's program is our money guy, and he'll talk about bad weather in Colorado affecting the crop. Also, we'll have a jelly bean that's got a special ingredient called CBD and now available in over 100 flavors. We'll talk about the opioid crisis and the impact on newborns. And lastly, we'll talk to a representative from the Federal Trade Commission on deceptive advertising of CBD products. This is Dan Perkins.
This is Dan Perkins. Our guest today on the conversation is our money guy, Anthony Planis, and he's from Banyan Hill Publishers. And he's going to help us talk about two particular issues that happened over the last time we talked. One, there was a major freeze in Colorado, which looks like at the moment has maybe destroyed about half of the outdoor grown cannabis crop. Real concern about how much of that crop is going to be able to be harvested and what the implication will be for the price and supply of cannabis. And the second thing we're going to talk about is Bank of New York Mellon deciding they're no longer going to trade cannabis stocks. So, Anthony, what's your take on the weather?
Yeah, so the freeze in Colorado has hit some of the new outdoor growers especially hard. I was reading that Lasuenius Farms lost about half of their crop, and this is the first year that they're growing crop. So That freeze hit them pretty hard. The thing is that we can't measure the effect that this is going to have the same way we do if there's like flooding, say, in like soy country or like corn farms get hit by hail, because there's no futures contracts, there's no spot prices for hemp or any of the cannabis varieties yet. So we can't look and see exactly how it's going to affect things. But because there's no interstate trade, the impact is going to be limited to Colorado. And so, I mean, we might see CBD in Colorado bump up in price a little bit, but also this is bringing on a lot more production. So I think what it's going to do is probably stabilize prices more than anything.
So on that same subject, is much of the cannabis that's grown in Canada outside, or is it all undercover?
The vast majority of it, almost all of it, is grown inside. And then there's a few experimental or research outdoor growers, but most of it in Canada is still grown inside.
So I also, not specifically tied directly to cannabis, a couple of companies made some major moves, especially on the vaping side of the business. I saw where one company reduced their sales force by, or their employees by 25%. Weedmap cut 65 people out of their company, saying that the business isn't what they thought it was going to be. And I'm wondering if you're seeing that across the board, is a lot of people are not seeing the kind of business they thought they were going to see.
Yeah, I'm seeing that a lot with multi-state operators in the U.S. There's a cash crunch right now. So a lot of these companies sprung up and they weren't well capitalized, which means they didn't have the cash to really keep operations going until they became profitable. And they overstretched themselves. And so now we're seeing all of them, kind of, not all of them, but the ones that overstretched getting crushed. Basically, they're defaulting on the debt. And because the markets aren't good right now, most of the stocks are relatively low, they can't go and raise money by selling more shares because there's no buyers that are willing to take prices anywhere near what the shares are actually trading at.
So would you expect to see, as a result of this, would you expect to see bankruptcies?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is a thinning of the herd right now. And so what we're going to see is the strongest players that have the best connections are going to make it out of this. And then, you know, all these names that popped up to try and get in and get rich quick are going to get, you know, cleaned out.
Most of these places are tied to a dispensary license. And I read an article recently where they're talking about, rather than try and go through the consolidation, as you mentioned, it was talking about perhaps the best way to buy a dispensary license is in the secondary market, not trying it to buying it from the state or the local government. So let's move on to Bank of New York Mellon. Now, I seem to remember a couple of years ago, maybe longer than that, Bank of New York Mellon had some accounts that were, they were actually taking deposits for those cannabis operators. And then all of a sudden they said, nope, we're going to close the accounts and send you the money, and you got 30 days to find a new home. And here they are again saying, well, we're not going to trade your stocks, and we may not take your cash. So do you have a clue what's going on there?
What they've done is basically they've said that they are not going to list or host the stocks for companies that are listed or that operate within the U.S. And so this is kind of a confusing subject, but to break it down simply, a U.S. operator can't list on the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ. And so what they do is they actually list on another exchange, like the Canadian Securities Exchange, which isn't as big as their main Toronto exchange. And then what they do is then they cross list. And so they go over the counter with, you know, BNY, basically they'll list the OTC then. And so what they do is they hold shares in trust of the Canadian Securities Exchange. And so that's why most U.S. investors, retail investors at least, will trade the over-the-counter or the OTC tickers. So these companies, BNY is basically saying, we're not going to host the OTC for these companies anymore. And so investors can still trade them on the Canadian Securities Exchange, but because the fees are higher on that, what we're going to see is a lot of retail investors that are kind of casually partaking are going to get cut off because they basically, instead of $5 or now $0 to trade, it's now 20 or 25 up to $50 per trade. And so that's going to dissuade a lot of people. And so that's going to cause a little bit of a liquidity crisis because there's just not going to be as much volume trading on these same stocks.
Is Bank of New York a big player in this secondary market?
Yeah, they're a huge player. They have something like 30-some-odd trillion dollars that's under their management. And so a lot of that is over-the-counter or foreign-listed stocks. So Canadian companies, for instance, aren't breaking the rules. And so like Organigram or something like that is going to be able to continue to trade because they operate in Canada, they're listed in Canada, but they also have a listing in the U.S., but because they don't have any illegal operations in the U.S., so to speak, they're totally fine.
We're speaking with Anthony Flannis from Banyan Hill. Anything that we should be looking at, Anthony, over the next week before we visit again that you're following?
The main thing I'm following right now is just continuing to follow the vaping crisis, what's going on, the information that's coming out of that. And then also, this is further ahead, not just this next week, but how the new Cannabis 2.0 in Canada does. And so that's going to be like the edibles and infused products and the vape pens. I'm really curious to see how that all rolls out, and we're going to start to see that in the coming weeks. So those are the two main things that I'm keeping an eye on right now.
Terrific. We've been speaking with Anthony Flannis from Banyan Hill Publishing. I got it right this time. So thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And tell our audience how they can get a hold of you.
Yeah, so go to banyanhill.com, and there you can look me up, Anthony Planis, and find out all of the information that I publish.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Anthony.
Thanks for having me.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network, W420 Radio Network, is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing teams. America's Cannabis Conversation, which airs each Saturday at 4:20, offers listeners insight and information on the exploding cannabis industry. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach hyper-targeted audiences, literally neighborhood by neighborhood. We are looking for motivated individuals who want to start their own businesses in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To get more information on this opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the conversation. We have a very, very interesting gentleman who's going to talk to us about innovation, a person who's been an innovator all of his life, David Klein. David, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
David is a gentleman who has had a very fascinating life. He is a serial entrepreneur. He's done a lot of things. His most famous at the moment is Jelly Belly, the multiple flavored jelly beans that you never knew what you were going to get for sure when you bit into them. I'm curious, as I watched the documentary on you on YouTube yesterday, you seem to have a unique ability to try and discern what consumers want. Where do you think that came from, David?
I've always been curious, and I've always loved the candy industry, even from a youngster. I worked in a liquor store that my grandparents owned, and my job was to stock the candy section. I was 6 years old at the time. And I had a fascination about the different candy companies, where they were located, what they made, who acquired who, how companies changed hands. And I knew from that young age that I would be in the candy business. And I was positive. When people said, what do you want to do? Even though I went to law school, I knew I wanted to be in the candy business.
That's such a dichotomy of challenges, law school and
yes.
candy business. I mean, yes. it just yes. amazes me. That
they're on opposite ends of the spectrum.
6 years old, you started in the candy business.
Yeah, I was a liquor store that was next door to a gas station that was owned by Annette Funicello's dad.
It
was in Van Nuys, California.
And you ultimately went to law school, you said, and when did you come up with the concept for Jelly Bellies?
1976.
And were you out of school or still in school when that happened?
No, I was out of law school, and I was working as a nut and candy distributor in a business that I started from scratch. One of our customers was Famous Amos. I used to supply him with his pecans.
Famous Amos cookies.
Yeah, oh. Famous Amos cookies. He was at the corner of Sunset and Formosa in Hollywood.
Wow.
Wally Amos.
Right. And so you that's about when you came up with Jelly Bellies?
Correct.
Was that your first invention?
Yes, it actually was.
Your first invention is a block
jelly
product.
Yes, Jelly Bellies. That my first invention.
How did you come up with the name Jelly Bellies?
I used to watch Red Fox. He had a show called Sanford and Son.
Sure.
And one night they were talking about a musician by the name of Lead Belly.
Sure.
And I didn't know it at the time, but he went to jail for attempted murder.
Ooh.
So actually, Jelly Belly is named after a man who was not the best person in the world. But I remember that belly part. I just put it with Jelly Belly.
Now, you literally reinvented the jelly bean class. And you changed the shape, you changed the flavor, the texture, even to the polish on the outside of the beans. Did this come to you in stages, or did it happen all at once?
It happened all at once, actually.
Wow.
I knew that I wanted a small bean so that they would be low in calorie. They were four calories each. And I knew that I wanted one that would be flavored on the outside as well as the inside. Prior to that, most every jelly bean on the market was white on the inside. And if you bit into it and you saw that it was white, that meant every flavor, every inside was the same.
Mm.
And it was only flavored a little bit on the shell, if at all. The only flavors that you could really discern were the black ones, the licorice ones,
mm-hmm.
and maybe a few of the other ones. They all tasted alike. I did not want that to happen to my bean.
We're going to roll forward to when you decided you were going to create a new product, and that was your CBD-infused product. What made you decide to think about doing a new product infused with CBD oil?
Great question. For 43 and a half years since I left Jelly Belly, I wanted to get back into the jelly bean business. I had a 20-year non-compete clause from 1980 to 2000, so that took care of 20 years
where
I could not enter the business. I made other attempts prior to our CBD arrival, and for one reason or another, none of those they were never able to really get off the ground. And we were in Colorado Springs, actually. My wife fell. We were at a hotel, and she fell coming out of it, out of the patio. And we had to rush her to the hospital, and she was in a tremendous amount of pain. Nothing that they gave her could really help, and we were driving by one of the stores in Colorado, and I said, I'm going in there. Let me just see if I can find something. And I brought something out to the car, and it helped her immediately within at least 10-15 minutes. And I said to myself, we need to look into this when we get back to Florida. And that's how it really got started. That was a motivation to get started. And we decided to. We knew nothing about the field. I'll tell you something. There are so many wonderful people out there that were willing to guide us and to help us. We knew how to make candy, but we didn't know anything about isolate or milligrams or anything. We were like, yeah. We didn't know. We did not know, but we learned very fast. It took us about a year and a half to develop the formula. We finally developed it with 10 milligrams per jelly bean. We love the industry. We love the field. We love the industry. We love the people that have helped us. We love our customers. I've never been happier. And I always think that if that hadn't happened to me with Jelly Belly, I would not be in this industry.
I use the gummy bears. I live in Southwest Florida, and David lives in Central Florida. But I get my gummy bears from Amazon. And during the summertime, they come in a plastic bottle. And if they sit outside because I'm not here to open the door for the UPS guy, they sit out and they wind up being in one big blob. And David told me that's part of the problem of the formulization. And in his jelly beans, you don't have that problem. So you've reinvented yourself as a new entrepreneur in probably the fastest growing business in the United States for sure, if not in the world, with a consumer product that has its origins with Jelly Bellies.
Yeah, it does. It really does. And you can ship them anywhere in the world and not worry about it melting. We have 38 flavors. I've never seen any other type of edible with 38 flavors. You usually get 4, 5, or 6. And our flavors are distinct. And there's no gelatin in our formula. Most gummy bears contain gelatin, and we have no gelatin in there. We have 38 flavors, and they don't melt. So those are three really good features in my mind.
So, David, we just have a few seconds left. Please tell people how they can reach you and get more information about your fabulous new product.
You can reach us at our webpage, Spectrum Confections, with an S at the end, spectrumconfections.com.
We have been speaking with David Klein, who has invented a new CBD jelly bean that is getting tremendous play. David, thank you for joining the conversation today, and we'll have you back on real soon.
It's indeed been my pleasure. Thank you.
This is Dan Perkins, and this is breaking news on America's Cannabis Conversation. E-cigarette maker Juul confirmed this week that it will lay off 650 employees, or roughly 16% of its workforce, as the embattled startup reorganizes its business in the face of increasing regulatory pressure on the vaping industry. The cuts come after Juul last week voluntarily stopped selling its mint refill pods, which account for 70% of the company's U.S. sales. Juul last year stopped selling sweet and fruit-flavored pods in retail stores, citing their appeal to young users. The company last month also stopped selling them through the website. While Juul has claimed that its products are aimed at helping adult cigarette smokers quit tobacco, critics say the company targets younger consumers. More than 1,800 Americans across 49 states have been diagnosed with a vaping illness, according to the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. 38 people across 24 states have died from the disease linked to vaping. Juul also said it would cut costs by nearly $1 billion, including by laying off marketing and government affairs staff. A bare-bones marketing team will focus its efforts on direct marketing to adult smokers. Juul also suspended all broadcast, print, and digital advertising in the U.S. This has been breaking news from America's Cannabis Conversation. I'm Dan Perkins.
Welcome back to the conversation. This is Dan Perkins, and joining us today is an unusual gentleman in a very positive sense. He has a passion, which I think is extremely important. His name is Steve Roberts, and he is the president of the West Virginia Chamber of Commerce, and he has a special place in his heart for opioid babies and actually people with opioid crisis. So Welcome to the conversation, Steve.
Dan, thank you for having me, and thank you for that very nice introduction. I appreciate that so much, and I'm honored to be with you for a few minutes.
Thank you. When we talked earlier, you have some real concerns about the opioid crisis, and I'd like to start off by talking about your passion for what to do with the infants and the babies who are born addicted to opioid. You have a mission. What is it you're trying to do, and what is the West Virginia Chamber of Commerce trying to do about this problem?
So for your listeners, I represent the West Virginia Chamber of Commerce, which is a group of businesses that represent over half of our state's workforce. We are everything from the smallest to the largest businesses in communities throughout West Virginia. The Chamber of Commerce has been around since 1936, and we are viewed as the voice of business in West Virginia. And we, of course, recognized going back a number of years that West Virginia and much of Central Appalachia are in the throes of a terrible opioid crisis. We have lots of research on the reasons for that, the background associated with it, and so forth. And one of the things that we can be really proud of is that in West Virginia, while we, in some respects, have been one of the centers of the opioid crisis, we think we are also positioned to be the center for the solution to the opioid crisis, or perhaps I would be better to say solutions for the opioid crisis. One of the great things that has happened here is that in Huntington, West Virginia, Lily's Place opened. And Lily's Place was opened to help take care of children, babies, who would otherwise be in neonatal intensive care for drug withdrawal. Children, as probably most of your listeners know, children who are born to addicted mothers often, very, very often, have addiction as part of their physiology when they are born, and they have to be cared for, and it requires specialized care. It's very expensive. It adds to the cost of delivering babies who can become healthy. And what has happened is, in Huntington, where they recognized this was happening, a group of citizen volunteers, people very close friends of mine, got involved and brought together parents, concerned citizens, some people who had means to be able to support, others who were able to support with their time and talent. And they created this wonderful place. It's known as Lily's Place, and it is where children can go after they're born, when they can be safely checked out of neonatal intensive care and receive additional treatment. And they also receive the nourishment they need. They receive love from those who can come hold them and rock them when that is appropriate. It is overseen by physicians and allied health providers, and it is just working wonderfully. And one of the nice aspects about this program is the mothers, who are obviously in a fragile and needful place, have the resources that they need in order to get help and get on the road to recovery. So it's a much more comprehensive approach, but it's working, and it has fantastic results. It's attracted national attention. And while I may not be completely up on all of the famous people who have been there, I can certainly say that just recently, First Lady Melania Trump spent some time there, seeing what is happening and seeing the babies and seeing some of the mothers and seeing some of the adults who come in to help care for these babies. So that's an overview of one of the good things that is happening in West Virginia as a result of the opioid crisis.
So we're speaking with Steve Roberts, who's the president of the West Virginia Chamber of Commerce. Steve, is there any you have a website, and is there any information on what's happening in your state about the opioid crisis?
We of course, there are several sites to go to in West Virginia. The West Virginia Chamber's website is wvchamber.com, and we have portals to many other we have portals and links and so forth to many places, not only in West Virginia, but in other places where people can get additional information.
Steve, we got about a little over 3 minutes left, and I want to turn to, not that I'm amazed at what you're doing with the children. Let's talk about adults. What is it, do you think, is, from what I can gather, the real heart of this opioid problem in the United States is in Appalachia. Why do you think it's there?
You know, we have a number of working theories, and the first thing I want to say to your listeners is open-mindedness is important. You know, learning something every day can occur, even for people who think they've seen it all and heard it all. So we're still learning, and the learning is an ongoing process. But a couple of things that we specifically identify. One is, in central Appalachia, we have a very homogeneous population, and that we have many people who are descended from the Scotch-Irish pioneers. And we have many medical professionals who have studied this issue who believe that there simply is a link between some societies, some cultures, and addiction, that some people, because of what may be in their DNA, are more susceptible to addiction than others. We don't hold that out as an excuse, but we hold it out as something that might be very important to know more about and might be part of the answer connected to the opioid crisis. Then you layer onto, then you begin layering on, I think, other possibilities. One of the layers could well be that we are in a socioeconomic state that has led people to a sense of hopelessness. One of the things we do see is that in the communities that are thriving and more healthy, we have less addiction problem. In the communities that are really down and out, particularly economically down and out, we have a greater problem. I ask our state's drugs are what he viewed as the number one issue, and he very quickly said, we have places in our state where Narcan is not available. So we simply are losing lives due to lack of resources. And it didn't take him, you know, frankly, that's not the answer that I maybe would have thought would have been his first answer, but I trust his judgment on this, and I trust what he has seen and experienced and is working on. And then, of course, you know, we're all in West Virginia reading the great literature that's out there on the subject, trying to understand everything from the background as to how this began. Soft tissue injuries are prevalent in outdoor work where we have tree cutting and so forth. They're prevalent in the mining industry, and it could simply be that we had a lot of people who began to be treated for soft tissue injuries, I said it twice, injuries, and within their industry, the prevalence of this just wasn't noted until the epidemic had begun. And we think that's a possibility also.
We've been talking with Steve Roberts, who is the president and, I think, visionary of the West Virginia Chamber of Commerce, about the issue of opioid addiction, especially for children, but also give us a little history of what's going on in Appalachia and why it's there. Steve, how can people get a hold of your organization again, please?
Yeah, the best way is through our website, wvchamber.com, and I'm happy to share our phone number. It is area code 304-342-1115. And Dan, thank you for your interest. Thank you for the attention and interest that your listeners are paying. And I guess I would stress The big thing I would stress is the importance, at least from our point of view, of open-mindedness, of knowing there is a lot more to be learned, of looking at this not so much through a criminal justice lens, but through a healthcare lens. And you know, we do believe that in particularly West Virginia, that recovery is happening, that more and more people are finding their way into recovery, and that we really are responding in appropriate ways. Yeah, but we're always open to new ideas and clearly looking for resources to be able to do more.
Steve Roberts, thank you for joining us in the conversation today.
Dan, thank you so much for having me. You take care.
This is Dan Perkins, your host and co-creator of America's Cannabis Conversation. I want to take a moment to tell you why we started this groundbreaking network and show. Hundreds of thousands of people who work in the cannabis industry trying to help people are not permitted to tell their story on the public airways of radio and TV. In spite of these restrictions, the American cannabis industry is growing at about 35% per year and accelerating. As you listen to this show from time to time, you will hear real people telling their story of how cannabis helped them, or business people who grew their business. When I started talking to people in the exploding cannabis business and telling them what we were trying to do, I heard this common question: when can you help me? Well, we are going to give you a voice. We promise to do our best to bring you a high-value, entertaining program. We want from you what you want from your customers. Come back for more. And now, let's meet our guest.
Welcome back to the conversation. What we want to talk about is something that we have been talking about for some time, but we've got a new expert. A lot of people who are reading article after article about the advantages of CBD and are interested. In fact, it's growing at about 133% this year over next year in terms of sales. The problem that I'm concerned with, and we had a London pharmacist on about several weeks ago who gave us 12 points to look at when you're trying to decide whether you should buy a particular CBD oil. We are fortunate enough today to have with us Rich Cleland from the Federal Trade Commission. This is the first time that I've ever been involved in my 75 years with the Trade Commission, and it's over an issue of advertising for CBD. So, Rich, thank you for joining us today and joining the conversation.
My pleasure.
Let's start, first of all, how people can get in touch with you. How do they find out about what the Federal Trade Commission does?
They can go to the FTC website, FTC.gov, and there's all kinds of consumer information there, as well as if they have a complaint, they can file a complaint with the FTC.
Okay. So I'm not embarrassed to admit that I don't know much about the Federal Trade Commission. Can you give me a sense, and our listeners, a sense of how the Federal Trade Commission protects them?
Yes. Basically, the Federal Trade Commission is, I would describe it as the nation's consumer protection agency. In my particular area, we look at advertising and whether advertising is truthful and the claims that are made in the advertising are well supported by the appropriate evidence. If we find that companies are making claims that are not supported or are false, we can bring enforcement actions against that company, recover consumer redress in appropriate cases, and get cease and desist orders and court injunctions prohibiting deceptive claims in the future.
Now, in your most recent activities, Rich, you've been partnering with the Food and Drug Administration on consumer products. Can you give us some insight as to why you're working together on this particular issue?
Well, the CBD market is really a new market, really sort of burst on the scene after the Farm Bill was signed late last year. In a short space of time, 6 months or so, hundreds and hundreds of new products with all sorts of claims have come out into the market. I think there was a sense that when CBD was taken off of the scheduled substance list, that there are a lot of entrepreneurs out there that thought, it was legal to sell it. They could make any claim they wanted to make for it. It was like selling toasters. And in fact, there are a lot of federal regulations that apply to the advertising of any type of oil or tincture or dietary supplement or drug product that contains CBD. And we thought that it was important for both of us, both agencies, the FDA and the FTC, to lay down a marker that this is an area that we are going to look at carefully and bring up enforcement actions where that's appropriate.
So have you been, have the FTC and the FDA been working together, not specifically on this particular issue we're talking about, CBD, but is there precedent where you've worked on a regular basis jointly, or is this something unusual?
It's not unusual. We have issued joint warning letters in a lot of different situations, particularly where there is some type of public health concern, outbreak of a virus or something, and the companies rush into the marketplace to offer a miracle cures for it. Before we issued the three CBD letters, on the first three CBD warning letters, the previous month we had issued three warning letters to companies just making Alzheimer's and Parkinson's claims for their products that were not CBD products.
Wow. So what enforcement powers do you have, if any, if somebody continues to advertise falsely?
Well, we can file a lawsuit against the company. We can obtain an injunction against the company from marketing with deceptive claims. And like I said earlier, if we win the case, the court can order the company to disgorge any ill-gotten gains or to pay consumer redress. So, we do have pretty strong remedies if a company fails to comply with the law.
Are you surprised at how quickly after the Farm Bill passed that, as you pointed out, hundreds of products came out? And I would think there must be hundreds, if not thousands, of new companies that have been formed. I mean, I get advertising all the time, multiple times a day on my internet because of the nature of what I do with the show. But were you surprised at how prolific the expansion was?
Yes, absolutely. I've been doing consumer protection work now for 40 years, and I've never seen anything explode the way that this has exploded. So I was quite surprised. I can't walk into a gas station, and I'm sure your listeners is probably the same, or any kind of convenience store, and not see CBD products all over, up there on the impulse buying shelf. I look at those products and I think, we don't know where those products came from. We don't know whether those products were purchased or produced under good manufacturing GMPs or not. So, I was surprised, and I'm also concerned with the explosion because, just the sheer number, I think, suggests to me that some of these products aren't what they purport to be.
So how do you decide? Is it simply because of the advertising? Do you or the FDA look at any of the products and analyze them, test them to see even if they got any CBD oil in them or not? Or is that not either one of your bailiwicks?
Normally, the FTC would not do that. We look primarily at the advertising claims, and that's where our principal jurisdiction lies. So, you know, but if we're looking at, for example, a company claims to have substantiation for a claim they're making for a CBD, we want to make sure that, you know, the whatever evidence they're relying on, the CBD, if it's a study, for example, that the CBD used in the study was the same CBD that's in their product. So to that extent, we care about what's in the product, but not the way that FDA might look at it.
So is with your partner, with the FDA, somebody's making an Alzheimer's claim with CBD, will they even test the product before they take any action? Because there isn't any evidence, any testing data that would support that contention. It's basically bogus.
Yeah, I think that probably not at this point. I'm not privy to what FDA has done in terms of product testing with these products. You know, from the FDA perspective, none of these CBD can't lawfully be added to any food product or any dietary supplement product at the current time. So the actions that FDA have taken thus far have basically been to tell manufacturers that it's not just that they can't make a claim, but they can't sell the product with CBD in it.
Do you have any triggers that you, when you see a piece of advertising, that it's an automatic trigger that you need to look at this more closely?
Well, we're looking for marketers that are making serious disease claims for CBD products. Claims relating to Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, pain from arthritis and other similar disease conditions. You know, there are plenty of those out there, and right now those are our priority.
Okay. So if a person wanted to bring a product to your attention, how would they get a hold of you and let you know that they think there's something wrong here?
Well, what I would suggest is that they go to the FTC website and they file a complaint. They don't have to have purchased a product to actually do that. If they see something that they think is outrageous or suspicious, they can go to the FTC website, file a complaint, be sure and indicate that it's a CBD product, and we'll take a look at those.
Do they have to supply you with, even though they didn't, advertising piece or anything that, or just they need to call your attention to the name of the product?
Well, hopefully, they would identify themselves in the complaint and provide us with contact information. So if we wanted to contact them to see if they had any copies of advertising or anything, we could do that. What's most important, though, is that they clearly identify who the company is or the distributor and where they saw the advertising.
We're going to put Rich's contact information on the website with this show so that if you get a chance to get it down, you can figure out how to get to the Federal Trade Commission and issue a concern or a complaint. So, Rich, we talked about consumers. I think since you're the regulatory agency and you're in charge of oversight for advertising, maybe we would take a few minutes and talk about what the product manufacturer and distributors need to know about looking at their advertising. It's amazing to me when you see on the internet an ad for a CBD oil, the copy goes on forever and ever and ever, and you can't find the price until you put in an order to buy it. So, and I don't see any of that as really being disclosure. So with the problem that you're facing now on a regular basis of calling manufacturers and distributors to task, what kind of advice would you give people who are contemplating buying CBD oil and making something out of it for consumption by consumers?
Well, I think what I would start with is the sourcing of the CBD. As a manufacturer, very few of the companies that are selling CBD actually manufacture the CBD. So they're buying it from contract manufacturers or from other sources. And so one of the first things they need to pay attention to is where is their CBD being sourced from and whether it is being produced under good manufacturing procedures, and make sure that, you know, you can authenticate that in fact it is CBD. So, you know, you would start with that. And, you know, the next thing I think you need to do is, you know, if you're going to sell it as CBD, as long as it is CBD, from the Federal Trade Commission standpoint, you know, that is not something that would be prohibited by the FTC Act. It's only when you attach a claim, some type of performance claim to that CBD product, that you need to be concerned about whether or not you have adequate support for the claim. So you need to know what the science is, and you you can't find that out simply by going to Google and typing in CBD and then reading what you're coming up with. It's a much more sophisticated process than that.
I'm curious how you would react to this question. Is that from my perspective, and I could be wrong, but from my perspective, it appears there doesn't seem to be any standardization of reporting required by either the Federal Trade Commission or the FDA on what should be on the label. We need to know what's in our tomato soup can, but do we really are there regulations out there that give the consumer the kind of information that they need on the label of the cannabis product they're buying?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. There's nothing in the FTC rules or regulations that cover the labeling of products. That's something that is within the primary jurisdiction of the Food and Drug Administration. And I can understand the frustration there because because FDA doesn't recognize CBD as a legitimate product at this point, as a legal product at this point. It's not clear what labeling requirements would apply to that product. Since CBD, you know, there's labeling requirements, for example, that apply to dietary supplement products. But CBD can't be a dietary supplement product. And if you put it into a rub or something like, you know, into a cream or something like that, that might make it a drug, but it would be an unapproved drug. So, you know, it's sort of until there is some clarification of what the regulatory status of CBD is, it's kind of premature to talk about what should be on the label.
But if we understand that the federal government basically took it off of the controlled substance list with the elimination of the ability to sell hemp and byproduct, it's no longer on a federal basis. It's my understanding with that inclusion in the Farm Bill, it's no longer a controlled substance. So is the FDA behind in there in what they need to do?
Well, the FDA is struggling with this, with the question of what to do with CBD. According to the warning letters that FDA has sent out to companies selling CBD products, in this world there are three types of products. There are cosmetics, there are drugs, there are foods, and dietary supplements are included in the food group. Well, it can't be a food or a dietary supplement. FDA has said that, and it could be either a cosmetic, depending on what the claim is. I don't think there's, you know, and I suppose you could make a cosmetic claim for it, but you can't make a drug claim for it because there's other than the epilepsy treatment drug. There are no approved drug claims for CBD. So other than that one exception, it can't be a food, a dietary supplement, or a drug.
So if it can't be a drug, it can't be a dietary supplement, it's in limbo. Nobody seems to know what it is.
It is in limbo, and it's a question that FDA is working on right now and taking input from stakeholders and trying to resolve. So until that's done, I think there's been a reluctance on part of some companies, understandably, to develop products in this area.
You pointed out about the going to a gas station and be able to find CBD oil. A friend of mine who was in his local Ace Hardware, and he went up to the register and there's a tincture bottle of CBD oil. I'm amazed how fast that it is permeated into the whole distribution system in the United States. And you're right, there's no way of telling whether there's any CBD at all in that bottle. So it would seem to me that one of the most important things that the government needs to do is to set out a set of standards of how it should be controlled and how it should be tested. Do you disagree with that?
It is imperative that we get a resolution about what is appropriate CBD, and that's not completely clear, and how it can be legally marketed.
So if in our closing minutes, if you're an entrepreneur, as you talked about, and you're opening up a dispensary and you want to sell CBD product, where do you go for help? Anywhere?
Well, I think if you ask me that question, I think the only thing you could legally do at this point is put CBD on the label, assuming that it was CBD, and sell it without any claims whatsoever.
We've been speaking with Rich Cleland from the government and the Federal Trade Commission of all of the challenges that distributors and manufacturers have to deal with CBD products. Rich, one more time, how do people get in touch with you?
Well, they can go to the FTC website, and if they want to file a complaint or bring something to our attention, they can use the complaint process and identify the complaint as being about CBD, and we can look at that. And, my name is Rich Cleland, and I'm an assistant director in the Division of Advertising Practices at the Federal Trade Commission. And, you know, I can be contacted.
Well, Rich, thank you for your conversation today. And I learned a bunch of stuff, and I hope that our listeners will. So thank you for joining us today.
All right. Thank you for this opportunity.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network, W420 Radio Network, is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing teams. America's Cannabis Conversation, which airs each Saturday at 4:20, offers listeners insight and information on the exploding cannabis industry. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach hyper-targeted audiences, literally neighborhood by neighborhood. We are looking for motivated individuals who want to start their own businesses in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To get more information on this opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com. We hope you enjoyed the conversation today and invite you to join us next week. By the way, you can go to our website and download previous shows. So go to the website, americascannabisconversation.com, download shows, and look who's going to be on next week. This is Dan Perkins, and thanks for joining the conversation.